This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 4th of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design every single week on Monocle 24. Coming up today, we head to Cape Town to find out how the year's festivities for the World Design Capital celebration are getting underway.
We have these challenges and we're open about being this urban laboratory for the world. And I think Design Capital is our magnifying glass and our platform for both celebration and introspection.
And we drop in at a new exhibition at London's Royal Academy, which showcases how the world's architects are taking a fresh look at how we experience space.
An architect should make as much nothing as possible. You make the space in which people are. So for us, I suppose, we're trying to emphasize that light is a free ingredient on the earth.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Let's begin on the African continent. South Africa this year celebrates 20 years of democracy away from apartheid rule, while Cape Town itself has much to be happy about. As we've touched on before on Section D, 2014 is the year it becomes World Design Capital, taking on the mantle from Turin, Seoul and Helsinki. Where the potency of design was already appreciated in those former hosts, Cape Town sets out its stall with much to celebrate, but also much to achieve. Gillian DeBias reports.
An enormous bright yellow promotional picture frame has been erected along Cape Town's waterfront. Within its transparent canvas, you can see the most spectacular view of Table Mountain sitting proud. And so it should be, for amidst fierce competition, Cape Town won the honour of being named World Design Capital for 2014. Turin was the first city to be honoured back in 2008, and since then the biannual design baton has been passed on to Seoul and most recently Helsinki, all very different cities with very different relationships to the term design. In South Africa, there are still some very serious problems relating to residual apartheid issues, race relations, and socioeconomic disparity. So for Elaine Riesberg, CEO of Cape Town World Design Capital, it's imperative that the vision for 2014 focuses on design's problem-solving capabilities.
We needed to do quite a bit of planning to make World Design Capital digestible to the citizens of Cape Town in the first place. So there are connections with business, there is a lot of sustainability. Cape Town and Greater Cape Town happens to be a living lab. I don't think it's any mystery that South Africa struggles with some awful diseases, so there's a lot around research, and then medical technology that sits on top of that. And then we have the softer issues that are the hardest, of course, that are around reconciliation. And when I talk about reconciliation, it's not just socioeconomic, sociopolitical, it's also very often solving the problems, the hard architecture of apartheid. I'm hoping that World Design Capital will start those conversations, say, how do we want to live in this city? What will it look like?
In a city with much to resolve, this is as much an urbanism story as it is one about design. And those involved are keen that issues highlighted this year are more gritty than pretty. Cape Town's moment in the spotlight is not going to be airbrushed, according to Rashik Fattar, founder of the think tank Future Cape Town.
We have these challenges and we're open about being this urban laboratory for the world. And I think Design Capital is our magnifying glass and our platform for both celebration and introspection. And hopefully being a part of telling that story about where we've come from and where Cape Town's going.
450 officially selected projects will take place throughout the year, many encouraging citizen design-driven thinking and most putting everyday people centre stage.
In Cape Town there's immense love for the city, and so how do you translate that into meaningful changes for everyone who lives here? We're always making these small and big strides, and the potential is that whether it's tourism or the design of our city, we still can change things. We're not that far along perhaps as Sydney or Melbourne or Vancouver is, where things are pretty much fixed and you have to improve around that. We still have the potential to to make these big and bold changes which will transform our city for the next century, perhaps.
Cape Town used to have a vibrant manufacturing sector, and World Design Capital Board members are hoping to reinvigorate the city's maker community. Porky Heffer, designer and founder of the creative agency Animal Farm, stresses the importance of mobilising the design community and incentivising it.
How do you sustain things that they can grow beyond 5 people or 14 people and create a brand or an industry that has a legacy? And I think that's the most difficult thing with South Africa, is to leave positive legacies that continue to grow and continue to be fruitful. Most of the legacies in South Africa are negative. And I think it's easier to be negative about a negative as opposed to going, okay, how are we going to make this right? A lot of it has to do with investment from corporates. Most of the big corporates in South Africa are 1 foot in, 1 foot out. And more we're embracing international brands because of a lower cost. Mass manufacture is very difficult in South Africa. We don't have the numbers to meet in a market. So it's very difficult for us to do a high production run that we can start making a profit. And I think that we've got to get people to be proud of South Africa, proud of South African design.
Design education is quite young in South Africa and even younger in Cape Town. So I'm very pleased with the way the programs come together, and I think that we're going to set a different standard for World Design Capitals going forward. I mean, people are going to have to dig deep to do better than we do.
For Monocle in Cape Town, I'm Gillian Tobias.
Gillian's film on the launch of Cape Town World Design Capital 2014 is now playing on monocle.com. University campuses don't often make headlines, unless there have been some disturbances on the ground, that is. But the new campus of Vienna's University of Economics and Business is on everyone's lips in Austria at the moment. Designed by a handful of world-renowned architects, including British avant-gardists Sir Peter Cook and Zaha Hadid, it boasts innovative and colourful buildings, as well as a park-like atmosphere thanks to its location near the city's legendary Prater Funfair. But is it really the university of the future as it's being plugged? Our Vienna correspondent, Alexei Korolyov, finds out.
Most of us have been in or around colleges and will readily picture one in our heads. But try and imagine a university that is completely out of this world. Well, you'd probably still be nowhere near what the new campus of Vienna's University of Economics and Business looks like.
Wir kommen zu dieser symbolträchtigen Handlung. Dazu bitte ich nun den Rektor der Wirtschaftsuniversität, Professor Dr. Christoph Badl, zu uns.
A glittering opening ceremony in October last year.
Die WU steht erstens für Vielfalt an Sichtweisen auf Wirtschaft und Gesellschaft.
University head Christoph Badl says the new campus reflects new thinking in politics, economics and architecture.
Sie steht drittens für Verantwortung gegenüber Wirtschaft, Gesellschaft und Politik.
Now, whatever about the first two, the buildings here are certainly unorthodox.
My building tries to be a piece of city. I try to be not a building, more like a facade of a street.
This is Spanish architect Carme Pinos, who designed one of the university's department buildings, recorded in a television interview some 3 months ago.
And I try to make these windows that are like a game, that erase the different level and make each window different, no? It's a game.
As part of the same television program, Sir Peter Cook talks about the university's administrative complex designed by his London-based Crab Studio.
And we also, I think, make it a very jolly building, a very cheerful building. We think that often in Vienna you have these grey days, you know, and you have these long grey streets. And if you notice, our building has a lot of little pockets and nooks and crannies and so on. That's part of it too, that they're special places where an individual person can go or another person can go, rather than just a bland, straight thing.
In fact, nothing about this entire area here is dull.
Actually, the way the campus is designed is about communication, but not just between the students, but everyone, yeah? Like professors, students, and people who work here.
Jean-Pierre Bolivar is a member of the Vienna-based group Bus Architecture, which developed the layout of the campus.
Nowadays, there is a very important, let's say, discussion or argument about, okay, why should we meet at the university and why not just be at home with a couple of friends, turn my computer on and connect with my professor. This university is about being here, having physical contact with people.
But how does this site interact with the rest of the city? What is its urban context? Architecture critic Isabella Marbo has the answers.
As a building spot, they chose a plot of 90,000 square meter between Prater and Viertel 2, which is also a very new office center. So this is an area in general where a lot of development is happening, and which also used to be a red light district not so long ago. So this is a transformation of a part of the city going on now.
Marbo followed the construction of the campus closely.
I think in the end there was a big effort so that this is not becoming a gated community or a campus which can't be accessed by normal people or by Viennese people, and you can observe it was opened this autumn, that in the last 3 months the people really started to inhabit it.
For some people at the university this can be all too literal. Here's, for instance, what one student told a YouTube interview a month or two ago.
The campus is incredible. I'm really, really into it. And I feel that that's the place where I really want to study and live. Basically, I live in a campus, I think, with all this workload.
Another student admires the campus cafes.
We already used all the bars. That's where we are. We don't go to lectures. We have lectures in the bars and cafes. That's what we do. That's what students do. That's what you should do as well.
As we settle down in one of these cafes, Jean-Pierre Bolivar of Bus Architecture recalls his own student days.
I had the opportunity to study in Colombia and in Vienna. I mean, these both universities were very, you know, like artistic. So we used to have a lot of space, but it was very mono. It was just one kind of space, you know, like, and the same space for everyone. And what I think is very, very nice here is like you have different scales, you know, like you have wider rooms, you had smaller rooms, you had different auditoriums, you had red auditoriums, you had green. We are hoping that people find different, you know, like lovely places. Everything that you see is almost different. Every building is different. You see a lot of public spaces also with different textures, with different possibilities of meeting people.
But it's this architectural diversity which has attracted some disapproval.
So everybody did his own architecture, found his own language, his own solution, and the idea of creating some coherence over the whole area, also in terms of building, not only in terms of open area and master planning, was actually lost in the end.
This is Christian Kuhn, chair of the architectural campaign group Architekturstiftung Österreich. Despite his criticism, he takes a long view.
There are also fashions in architecture and even fashions in university design. So you have the Freie Universität Berlin from the 1960s, this concept of really creating a lot of connections between people, redundant circulation systems, so you get people talking to each other, which was rather naive and did not really work out. So it will take some time before you can judge if the whole thing really worked out.
For critic Isabella Marbo, it's the idea that matters.
I think you can argue about the fact if these different architects' ways of building fit together, but for me what rests is the wish to do something special, and I think this is something you must respect.
For Monocle in Vienna, I am Alexei Korolev.
Much more to come on the programme. We'll talk eco-motorbikes and prick our senses in a London exhibition.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Now, on last week's episode of Section D, Monocle's Alexa Firmenich chatted with several of Switzerland's foremost urban thinkers about the forces shaping Swiss cities. This week, we'll be moving on to examine more concretely how these cities, building by building, are being constructed. Alexa went along to the Swissbau in Basel to discover the major players and newcomers working behind the scenes. Her first stop was at Glasstrosch, a century-old Swiss glassmaking company.
Main glass we're producing is the architectural glass. And the second part is design glass and automotive glass. So that means glass for cars, for trains, for airplanes. The best example is the Bugatti Veyron. There we are delivering the whole glass for the whole car. And for the trains in China, we deliver the glass for the fastest train in China. And we are working with Mecaplex, that's a producer for glass for sport airplanes, for example. So we are very strong in that also.
That was Fabrice Nussbaumer from Glasstrosch. European leaders in glass production and transformation. They're still family-owned, and the 3,000 tons of glass they produce daily can be found in helicopters, aircraft carriers, and major airport terminals in all corners of the globe. It's quite a journey for a company that started off by transcribing the world's first photographs onto glass. I'm here at the Swissbau, a biennial trade fair in Basel, where over 1,200 exhibitors display anything you'd ever need to assemble, well, pretty much anything. Like Glasstrosch, KWC Taps is a company that reinvented itself from humble beginnings to become a world leader in its field.
The company was established in 1874, and then they started with music boxes. And then around 1900, when Edison invented the gramophone, the market was gone, so they had to find something else. So they said, okay, inside in these music boxes there were little brass parts, and let's do something else. Use the technology, casting, and so they started to produce taps for kitchen and bathrooms. KWC has a very strong position in the kitchen domain, so we are doing kitchen taps, premium luxury kitchen taps, and our latest innovation is this, is the KWC Zoe. Zoe is a faucet with an integrated LED light, which is quite strong, and it also has a pull-out aerator and a pull-out spray, which you can divert, and it also has the shape like a stream, like a water stream.
Innovation is key here. From Eternit Swiss Pearl's building casing, the material of choice for the likes of Le Corbusier and Max Bill, to Velopa, one of the first companies in Europe to produce bike stands. Keep an eye out for their new vertical parking system, fitting 12 bicycles in less than 3 meters of space in bike parks and train stations. And, of course, because it's Switzerland, there are some other, rather quirkier products also on display. I spoke with Peter Bracci from Swisswool, a company whose fleecy companions supply the insides for ski wear makers Mover and Ortovox.
We are collecting sheep wool as well as alpaca and yak wool that we are then producing into basically great innovative product. One of the goals is that all the sheep wool that is collected in Switzerland with the farmers is actually used as well in a high value chain of product, because it's a resource that is limited in any case. There are about 30 points around Switzerland where you collect sheep wool every 6 months. So once in the springtime, once in the autumn time as well. In springtime there are shorter, the hair is shorter, and then in the summertime they are a little longer. And then it will be washed and then produced into the different products that are basically a fleece component, which you probably know better by if you think about polyester. But you can do today, you can basically do every other product that is in polyester, you can do in sheep wool.
And so what kind of products do you make with the wool?
It started really in the first case with mattresses, where you have all the big manufacturers in Switzerland, Pico or Roviva or Riposa, who are using sheep wool within their mattresses. The second part is isolation for buildings, which is helping obviously having a better climate within the room, because sheep wool can pick up humidity and give it away as well. And then you have a third component that are bed linen. You can have duvets, for example, on a very high level. Again, the same thing, little mattresses that are fully Swiss wool for kids, because that's one of the things. And we are now producing as well different tapis, that means carpets, as well as acoustic panels, which will probably revolutionize a little bit the sustainability program of the Swiss nation as well, to a certain extent.
Could you maybe elaborate on that last part?
Yeah, in 2013, the Swiss government has decided to basically produce in all their public buildings, that could be schools, could be gyms, could be the parliament or other buildings, that they want to use only sustainable energy or is the sustainable materials. And so this will obviously take some time till it picks up really in every bit that you are doing. And we can see already a pickup for the army or for others where they are start using again natural fibers that are growing again.
In a special hall dedicated to kitchen and bathroom innovations, I couldn't help but to pause in front of a white enameled futuristic bathtub advertised by German spa company Klafs as our hydrogalvanic bathing experience.
So it's an electrical bath tube, and so you can make a polarization in the bath tube for the back and the leg end, and then you can fulfill your body with electrical energy. And you have two modes, relaxing and the energy level, and if you have the relaxing level, your energy goes out of the body, and then you can fall asleep as soon as possible. And if you have the energy modus, then you got the energy from the bath tube, and then you are full of energy for the next 6 or 8 hours.
And how does it work with magnets or?
Yes, with electricity inside the water. So it's a magnetic field, and it's 30 milliamperes of energy, of amperes, that's going into the body. And you can switch the level between 0 and 10. So you can also rise up the energy you got in the body.
Is there any chance of being electrocuted while you're taking your bath?
No. It's really safe.
Electrified bathtubs to bicycle parking systems and building materials. Swiss Spa this year showcased design innovations from the bizarre to the brilliant. A testament to Switzerland's cemented role in real estate projects worldwide. For Monocle, in Basel, I'm Alexa Firmenich.
Thanks, Alexa. We'll be back after this to hear from Kengo Kuma and the other minds behind a new exhibition at London's Royal Academy.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got The Curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. This month at the Royal Academy in London, some of the finest architects in the world have come together to create installations which explore just how it is we experience space and what it is about the built environment that moves us, even as during our day-to-day lives we may overlook it. It's called Sensing Spaces, and we sent Haley Joel Ott to explore.
My mother's house, the house I grew up in, has a certain feeling. Walking up the steep steps of the front stoop and opening the door into the warm yellow glow, narrow rooms, and creaky wood floors of her New York brownstone, there's an experience that the old walls create that is more than what can be seen, or smelled, or touched. And you can't get that feeling from a photo. because when it comes to spaces, there's truth in the cliché. To get it, you just have to be there. Kate Goodwin, curator of the exhibition Sensing Spaces at the Royal Academy of Art in London, which explores the emotional and deeply personal reactions we have to the architecture around us, explains.
It always struck me that it's very difficult to talk about those very personal responses we have to architecture and to space. The physical sense of being within it, which is bodily, it's sensory, and so often the mechanisms we have to talk about architecture is through representation. It's through the image, through popular press, it's sometimes with words. But I don't think anything is a substitute for what is actually it is to physically be within these spaces. And I think almost that's been proved to me. I've been working with these architects now for over a year, and I think a lot of their installations look exactly like their conceptual pieces did. The experience is so much more than I could have possibly imagined myself, even to walk around. And I think it reaffirms the importance of being within a space.
Architect Kengo Kuma's pieces are in two dark rooms. The lights are so low that the eye takes a moment to adjust before it can make out delicate bamboo rods tethered together and reaching up towards the ceiling, like you're very, very small and in a field of dry grass. Even before the eye finishes focusing, though, you feel that you're in an entirely different space from the other galleries. And that's because of the smell, which in one room is tatami and the other, Japanese cypress.
I want to show the importance of the non-visual effect of space. This is a kind of a criticism to the contemporary big building designs, and especially in Asia, the people try to get the stronger visual effects, as a bigger building, as a higher building. What I'm thinking is that the visual effect is a small part of architectural design. The most important part of architectural design is the conversation between the space and the human. And the aspect of smell is sometimes more important than visual effect. I want to minimize the material, minimize the structure as possible, and I want to maximize the smell as possible. So that attitude is very different from normal architecture. And also I want to make the space as dark as possible. In that kind of darkness, people can focus on that kind of smell. I learned that method from a traditional Japanese space. So in traditional Japanese space, the smell is very important. The memory of my old house, where I was born and grew up, is mainly about the smell of the house. I forget the plan of my house. I forget the details of my house, but I still remember the special smell of my space. When I use material, I always think about the smell of material. As material is not for making the shape of the building. The material is for the creating the interaction, communication with human.
There's a whole discussion within architecture that the eye has, you know, has taken the kind of a prominent role in aesthetics. But aesthetics is something to be discussed. There's comfort and there's scale of enclosure.
That's architect Yvonne Farrell, who, alongside her partner Shelley McNamara, has designed a dark cave-like room for the exhibit, as well as a bright, minimal space, contrasting the experiences of light and bright with those of heavy and dark.
Shelley and I often speak using the term from Alexandre de la Sota, the Spanish architect, who says architects should make as much nothing as possible. You know, that you make the space in which people are. So for us, I suppose, we're trying to emphasize that light is a free ingredient on the earth. We all wake each day, each happy day or sad day, whatever the day is, but it's the sun rises and the sun sets. And I think in urban life, we might forget that, because the alarm goes off, we work all day and then we sleep, and we're saying, you know, the moon is there, remember the moon, and that the pleasures of life can be free. It isn't that architecture is the realm of, it's not a discipline for the rich. Yes, architecture needs patrons, but it's also a sensibility about surface and light and comfort and volume. So here, in this huge question, we've really taken light, surface, time, and gravity. How do you strip something back so that you get something, just a little thing that rings a little bell somewhere? And I think in the darker space, it might be a primitive sense of just a little crack in a mountain can let in light, and it can be beautiful. But things don't have to be expensive or elaborate to be have a little poetry.
Architects Mauricio Peso and Sofia von Elrichshausen focus on scale and proportion. Their piece is a monumental timber platform elevated on four columns which the visitor can climb, ending up so close to the ceiling that the gallery, which only moments ago felt large and open, becomes entirely new, warmer and almost cozy. Mauricio explains their approach.
What we like about producing a piece of architecture is the possibility of establishing a specific relationship between neutral elements. So we don't design the elements, we don't design windows or doors or columns. Or what we do is to arrange them in a specific way, in a very singular way. So we use neutral elements or undesigned elements to produce very strong spatial structures. I think that the piece in itself is articulating so basic elements, and somehow it's a naked piece of architecture, that perhaps it's an invitation for people to be aware of those same elements in their own context, or in the street, or in the city. Just by looking at things directly, maybe they can find a certain familiar feeling, a natural feeling, or that if they look at it at that moment very closely, they can find something unexpected or unusual.
Sensing spaces at the Royal Academy is as much an exhibition of installations as it is a wake-up call to do more than just glance at the built environments that surround us. It reminds us of the power of architecture and challenges us to experience mindfully the spaces that make up our lives, our cities, our offices, and our visits home to our mothers. For Monocle in London, I'm Haley Joel Ott.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. We've all heard of electric bikes and cars, but this year the first high-performance cleantech motorcycle will launch in London, the Agility Saeta R. Monocle's Isabel Kaiser visits the workshop where a whole new generation of motorbikes is being crafted.
Walking through the rainy streets of Bloomsbury, I am led to a secret back door to meet the CEO of the motorbike brand Agility, Lawrence Marazzi, the man behind the new eco-friendly electric Saeta R bike, designed and manufactured here in London. The bike has been described with words such as muscular and aggressive, and I'm curious to find what makes it so striking. My first impression is one of a stallion, an almost equine black body looping over the engine underneath. It certainly sounds, at least for an electric bike, quite loud. Quieter than a regular motorbike, but still loud up close. I asked Lawrence, the man behind this operation, to talk me through the design process.
The design itself, as a result of having a completely different energy system, an energy storage system, absolutely intrinsically requires and demands a completely different vehicle architecture. So the architectural aspect and the way that the vehicle is packaged, how its systems and its layout are arranged, is intrinsically different from a gasoline motorcycle. Why are we different from every other motorcycle that's gone electric? Because they have adopted a conventional gasoline architecture and adapted it to electrical energy storage. This is a flawed approach because we simply have a different necessity. It's like saying you can build stables for horses and then make them for humans using the same form factors and shape. Architecturally, it's wrong. You will never get to the efficiencies you need to get to, and you will never really push things forward. So when we started with a truly clean sheet of paper and a very, very much pre-concept approach we were agnostic about energy storage. So we looked at a range of things, including gasoline derivatives, to try and evaluate and really see what the best way forward was from an efficiency point of view. So we evaluated hybrids, we evaluated battery fuel cell hybrids, we evaluated a range of kinetic energy storage systems. And the conclusion, to achieve the 2013-2014 target production competitive product objective, was to go battery electric. So you start with a very different architecture, not because you choose to be different, but simply because you are dealing with something very different. You're dealing with the storage of electrons, and you're dealing with the cutting edge of storing them as efficiently as you can. Now, that by efficient, I mean in as compact a structure, as light a structure, and arranged in the best way possible to give the rider the best possible ergonomic interface with the bike, to make the user experience, which is what a huge part of this product is, as good as it could possibly be. So we thought right from the beginning, all the way from the rider and from energy storage. That's where this vehicle came from. So the rider's ergonomy and the way literally of physiology of a human being operates has influenced the design and architecture of the motorcycle from one side, and the other side is dealing as efficiently as possible with storing this clean energy resource, which are electrons. And currently state-of-the-art batteries store at a quite incredible energy density compared to 10 years ago. The rate of progress is huge, yet it still has a significantly, very significantly lower energy density compared to a cup of gasoline. So we are the only manufacturers on the planet of something called a composite monocoque. So it's very similar to aircraft practice in Formula One. And our front and rear suspension is also unique. As a result, they can do things with this bike that they could otherwise not imagine doing on a normal bike.
For those who seek innovative, electric and well-designed options in the motorbike market, the Saeta R launches from London this year. For Monocle in London, I'm Isabel Kräser.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. And finally, let's send slightly closer to home. Monocle's sister company, Wink Creative, has just published its first monograph with German publishing house Gestalten. Wink Creative Designs Stories is an in-depth study of what the design agency has got up to since it was first established by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Thierry Brulé, in 1998. The company has worked with a roster of clients across many sectors. Its portfolio includes magazines for Lexus and Pictet, visual identities for Stella McCartney and Swiss International Airlines, and advertising for the Thai government and BlackBerry, all of which are showcased in this lovely book. I am now joined by Wink's strategy director, Steve Taruggi, and design director, Corinna Drossel, to discuss the new tone. Welcome.
Hello there.
Hello.
So let's kick off. I mean, it's an absolutely beautiful book. What are the sort of challenges of bringing a design agency to life in this way, to sort of stand back objectively and, I mean, look, Corinna, let's ask you to bring this to life in a visual way when it's actually based on lots of other people's work and image and design?
Well, that is precisely the challenge, in fact, to kind of really create a good balance between kind of the work that we do for other people, trying to communicate that we understand why a brand comes to us. Precisely, especially with the kind of variety of clients we have. But at the same time, we are a very aesthetically driven industry. And I think we can't hold back on kind of injecting a little bit of our own kind of approach and sensibilities into the book. So I think, it was a challenge, but I think we've kind of cracked it nicely. We've certainly relooked at a kind of our own identity as a design agency, which we were holding for the last 5 years. We really used the book as a springboard to kind of rebrand ourselves a little bit, but use the book kind of to do that very subtly so, and in a way that it, like I said, it gives enough room to kind of really let the client work speak for itself.
And if we look at the cover, this is absolutely beautiful still life shot, which I'm sure you can tell us all about. But it's because the agency has or is quite fairly well known for most of its publishing work that it's done. And actually, you brought that to life amazingly on this cover shot here. Tell us a bit more about how this shot came to life how this was a great sort of showcase of some of the more publishing work that Wing Creator has done.
Well, I think art direction is a big part of what we do every day. And I think also the kind of roster of talent that we work with, whether it's architects, stylists, photographers, illustrators. And I think here it was really important that we picked a photographer and a stylist that really kind of represented kind of where we wanted this book to go. And I think this cover image, we've actually had some great feedback on it. So I think the kind of idea was to kind of create something that really stands out on the shelf, something that summarizes, something that makes you excited to pick up the book and to show you there's a lot more in this inside. But it's also kind of really creating a sense of direction and a sense of style of what we believe is right and what we believe as a company we'd like to move forward to.
I just think there's an aspect to this that's quite challenging for an agency when we're so used to looking ahead to the next project, what's on the horizon, and always embracing the next opportunity. Whereas I think the exercise of looking back is almost goes against the culture of our day-to-day work. So I think the way the team, certainly working on the design and the editorial side of things, was really to look at this quite objectively and almost remove some of the group that are quite close to this every day, but allow a team to focus on it being a project in its own right rather than all kind of pulling it in a lot of different directions.
And Steve, I mean, you've been there since the beginning. I mean, it'd be good. How have you seen the agency change over the, what, sort of 15, 16 years since it started?
It's been really interesting. I think it's evolved enormously. As you say, I've been there since very early stages, and I kind of feel like I've had maybe four or five different jobs during that time. But the agency's very much mirrored what's happened in the publishing businesses that have run alongside it. So in the early days, we grew out of Wallpaper magazine, and obviously the work that came into the agency was reflected the interests of that were in the publication. So a lot of interiors work, a lot of, you know, fashion work, and then starting to get into transportation towards as the agency grew up. So, and then, you know, we jumped to the last few years, and the client mix is very reflective of the subject matter you find in Monocle. So more weighty issues, more business, transport, infrastructure, cities, place branding. The evolution of the agency is almost the evolution of a very singular sort of thought and kind of set of interests. Both businesses have evolved alongside each other. I think there's always been an expression of our interests represented in the publications that kind of go out of the building, and equally they're reflected in the kind of clients that are attracted to working with us and that we're attracted to work with on their projects.
Well, I've noticed just looking through the book, it feels incredibly up to date. I mean, I think when you sort of do a look back book like this, can be a bit self-indulgent of, and you know, there's been an amazing roster of clients since day one with Swiss International Airlines, but it feels like a lot of the content in here has come from the past couple of years. This is more of an editorial decision, but how do you go about just choosing from what must be dozens and dozens and dozens of very, very diverse, very, very important clients to then produce a book like this?
Well, we had an editor that we brought in very just for this project that's not got the emotional connection to these projects that I think the team have got. And I think that was a critical component of it, because it removed any sense of our own investment in the projects from the process. And that was really important for the, you know, for the sake of the book. I think when we work on projects, you know, we know the sort of blood, sweat and tears side of the story, whereas an editor is just looking at this and objectively saying, what's going to make a good book? Which projects deserve to be in here, which tell a story, which is how do we present a balance of the work? It'd be easy to do a book that becomes too transport heavy or too destination heavy or too retail heavy. So I think in that respect, it was very useful having a very objective and very talented editor involved.
Down to the nitty gritty, looking back through all of this, what are some of your, whether you worked on them or not, some of your sort of favourite projects now looking back at it and looking at imprint?
I think Swiss will always be an important one. That was the day when we won something and believed we could do something and realised we could do something way more than we had achieved up to that point.
And that was a huge, huge project, wasn't it?
It was. And it was, I think the key learning that I took away from that was in the pitch process, where effectively when we're surrounded by pitch processes now, that are so risk averse and looking for proof of repeatable process and have you worked in our industry before? And if that had been the case with Swiss, we never would have stood a chance. We went in there and literally filled a boardroom table with ideas and mock-ups and models and just inspired the board that we were capable of doing it, even though we'd never done such an extensive brand kind of identity before and across so many applications. You know, before we even think about the complexity of the political climate in Switzerland around that, around Swiss Air evolving into Swiss International Airlines. So I think that was a huge one in every respect, and just was the steepest learning curve we could have all possibly gone through to go from a magazine editorial mindset into the reality of agency life.
Yeah, with one of the world's biggest airlines. And how long does that whole process last?
It was several years. It was 6-7 years towards the end. Wow. But probably I'd say 90% of the work happened in the first year. They were on the necessity of the relaunch was put incredible pressure on the timings. And that really spoke to the strengths of the agency that grew out of a magazine. We were used to fast deadlines and delivering quickly and making shoots happen. And I think that the pace that we were used to was a huge asset in winning that project that probably set us apart from a lot of the agencies that were used to having longer timelines.
So, Steve, from one transport client to another, what other favourite projects have you got in the book?
I think staying with the transportation theme, one of the big projects we've got happening in the studio at the moment is the Union Pearson Express in Toronto. And that's a multi-year project, and we're just heading into the final year towards the launch of the service. So it's rare to have those opportunities like Swiss and Union Pearson Express where you're very heavily involved in every aspect of an experience, from the online booking through to the sitting on a train or a plane looking at an in-flight magazine. So I think that's being able to create the whole environment and every touch point is where the strongest representation of a brand can really be felt by a passenger in that kind of environment. So I really love those kind of projects where they feel so substantial, and you know that millions of people are going to be traveling through those environments and every day. And I think there's something very inspiring and hugely rewarding about being able to get involved in something of that magnitude.
And actually, it's a perfect example, Corinna, of this doesn't even exist yet. I mean, we've got the corporate identity, but how, as the book designer, how is it a challenge to bring these things to life in the book context?
Well, of course, you want to do justice to every little piece of work that you've done or that we have been doing so far for this brand. But at the same time, the book holds 60-odd projects. So we really had to do a very tight edit on the kind of the core elements of what we've been doing for this brand, but the elements that also really tell you the 360 story. So this was a challenge. But I think certainly, you know, the logo is something we're really proud of. The train design, we did include the renderings of the architecture that we have commissioned. We had a great collaboration with Swiss architect studio Hosoya Schaefer, who've been doing all the amazing rollout of our art direction. And then kind of also doing justice to our film work. We've done two promotional films that are housed on the websites. So here we felt that is visually really strong, or even in a print context, something you need to ask yourself, that we felt reflects very well what this brand stands for.
And you touched upon it earlier, but you mentioned the slight rebrand of when creative might be happening and this book being a slight sort of teaser of that. Can you give us any little clues of Wing Creative is going to look like in the next couple of months?
I suppose it's in the very obvious and exactly what you see. But to kind of put it into words, it's kind of really looking at kind of a new typeface that kind of really bridges something of a sense of gravitas and timelessness. But at the same time, you want to be looking forward. You know, we as a company, we see this book as a bit of a is a landmark, it's also a springboard to kind of what's to come next. The company's growing very fast. We have recently, I think, we've attracted a lot of more and more fashion clients, more and more design and architect studios, a cultural foundation. So these are kind of, I find next to these kind of bigger transport projects, I find that also very interesting. And because they give you a whole nother creative license. Anyway, so our identity. So I think it's looking at typefaces, looking at the color palette. Mm-hmm. And then it's kind of really finding the right mix of how you put those together to create something new. And that will be launched in the summer. And you will see this also on our website.
Fantastic. That's at wincreative.com. Steve, Karuna, thank you very much for joining me on Section D. And that brings us to the end of Section D. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com if you want to feature on the show or if you've got any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris, and following our chat with Corinna and Steve from Wink Creative, in honour of the work done by Wink, is the sonically symmetrical song Think by Collider. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.